Good evening.
I have a couple of things to say. One is the bowing mat goes a half inch from the altar. There's a half inch space, should be half inch space between the bowing mat and the altar. You may think that's picky, and it's picking, probably is. But there's very little space between the tom and the mat. So it needs as much space as possible in between the tom and the mat. You understand what that means, what I'm saying? Yeah. So when you adjust that, please try to remember that. The other thing is that I seem to have a pulled muscle or something. It's very painful in my leg. And for about a week. And so actually sitting this way is more comfortable than sitting in a chair. But if this gets uncomfortable, I'll have to stop and sit in the chair. So we've already had four classes. Three. And they're all together five. So we have two more, one tonight and then one next week. So I want to cover Mr. Hongjer. The book, I gave you some material, I think it was there. Yeah, some material of Hongjer, his practice instructions from Cultivating the Empty Field. And next time, I want to talk about Master Ajo's immersion in the treasury of light, which appears in a book called Minding Mind, translated by Thomas Cleary. It has a wonderful picture on the cover. These wonderful Chinese statues. You probably can't see them from there, but are in the Kansas City Museum. Believe it or not. I've never been there, but that's where they are. They're quite beautiful and made by someone who understands Zazen. So, before we start, though, I want to know if we need to, we'd like to review anything that we've talked about this far. Introduce Dogen's Komyo and Mr. Uman's Koan, which sort of opened up our discussion, our study. Last time we talked about, I read you the story of Nisarian, his, and there was light, his story of his, the first part of his life, before he was, when he was blinded, and his experience of being blind, and his experience of seeing the light as a blind person, which was quite moving. I think everybody was quite moved by that story as an experience. So I'm wondering if we have any questions about any of those things that we studied before. Anything that needs to be looked at. Okay, so tonight we're going to talk about Master Hongjer, Wanshi Shogaku in Japanese. This is a biographical note that I have. Hongjer lived in the 11th century, and was a predecessor of Dongyin's teacher, Rinjin, at Mount Tiantong in China. And he was very well regarded in his time. He was one of the most well-known and highly regarded Zen masters in at that time. And he was the proponent of what he called silent illumination Zen. So, you know, there are two sides, two main schools of Zen. One is koan study Zen, and the other is silent illumination Zen, which Dongyin called Shikantaza. Shikantaza means just sitting. There was a contemporary called whose name was Da Hui. Da Hui was also a very well-known teacher in China at that time. And these two teachers were maybe the most well-known, possibly. And Da Hui was a kind of critic of Hongzhi, because he was a Dharma descendant in the Linji school, Rinzai school. And Hongzhi was in the Soto school. And of course, the Soto school has, as someone described it, so Rinzai school is, at least in Japan, Rinzai school is like a general moving his troops, whereas the Soto school is like a farmer tending to his crops. So we're in the farmer school. Matter of fact, I've always enjoyed farming and gardening myself. And in my practice, when we were at Dwight Way, our first Zendo, I spent a lot of my time cultivating my little farm. I've always thought of this is kind of why I like lay practice. I've always been a kind of proponent of lay practice, which I feel ideally would be farming and zazen, cultivating the ground and raising food and with zazen as the fundamental thing, and all of that activity being an aspect of zazen. But you know, we all have jobs and whatever, you know, but we do cultivate our gardens. As a matter of fact, you know, everyone's work, everyone's daily activity is cultivating your garden, even if you have no flowers or no plants. So how we take care of our surroundings and how we relate to our surroundings and how we become one with our surroundings. This is all in the realm of zazen. So this is somewhat the characteristic of Hongzhi's silent illumination. When I think about this, I think about a mandala. A mandala has a center, and the center, from the center of the mandala, energy of one form or another radiates out from the mandala. And the center of the mandala is the original face, So each one of us actually is a living mandala. When we find our true center, we're truly a living mandala. And we radiate our energy in all directions. So the in the Platform Sutra, Sixth Patriarch has this wonderful poem, which I sometimes read to you. The master of the Dharma is like the sun in the sky, in an empty sky, radiating light in all directions. Hojur doesn't use the term mandala, as far as I know, but he certainly expresses himself in this way. So I did give you some. You may find the practice instruction in the middle of the page, and the last half of the previous one and the first half of the next one on the same page. But you know what I'm saying? Yeah. So what did I give you? I didn't have one of those, and you'll have to tell me. I know some things that I gave you. What's the first part?
Right at the beginning, a practice instruction. More or less, you might feel like.
What page?
Page 4.
Page 4, yeah. Yes. The bright boundless field, right? Yeah, the bright boundless field. So I'll read that, and then we can talk about it. He says, the field of boundless emptiness is what exists from the very beginning. You must purify, cure, grind down, or brush away all the tendencies you have fabricated into apparent habits. Then you can reside in the clear circle of brightness. So this is like the center of the mandala, your center, your mandala. The brightness or the emptiness is what exists from the very beginning. So you don't have to search for it. The third ancestor, Singsan, says, just, you don't have to search for it, just let go of opinions. Just let go of all opinions. And this is what he seemed to be saying. The field of boundless emptiness is what exists from the very beginning. You must purify. Purify means to not fall into duality. Not to fall into duality is what is called purity. Suzuki Roshi, in his introduction to Zen by Beginner's Mind, says, Zen is not so difficult. Zen is difficult, but not because it's difficult to sit zazen. It's difficult because it's hard to keep our mind pure. It's hard to keep our practice pure. Keeping our practice pure means not to fall into duality. Not to succumb to duality, to dualistic thinking. You must purify, cure, grind down, brush away all the tendencies you have fabricated into apparent habits. So, conditioned responses. We are creatures of habit, and we create habits all the time. And as a matter of fact, it's pretty hard to exist without creating habits. But how we experience ourselves moment by moment in a non-habitual way is awakening. Problem with being attached to our conditioned responses is that it's very hard to respond with a clean, pure mind because the conditioning always gets in the way. So it's very hard to see when the when our conditioning is responding, how to actually find that pure place, which is our original self, not clouded by habit patterns. Then you can reside in the clear circle of brightness. Utter emptiness has no image. Upright, independent, independence does not rely on anything. Just expand and illuminate the original truth, unconcerned by external conditions. Accordingly, we are told to realize that not a single thing exists. In this field, birth and death do not appear. The deep source, transparent down to the bottom, can radiantly shine and can respond unencumbered to each speck of dust without becoming its partner. The subtlety of seeing and hearing transcends mere colors and sounds. The whole affair functions without leaving traces and mirrors without obscurations. Very naturally, mind and dharmas emerge and harmonize. An ancient said that non-mind embodies and fulfills the way of non-mind. Embodying and fulfilling the way of non-mind, finally you can rest. Proceeding, you are able to guide the assembly. With thoughts clear, sitting silently, wander into the center of the circle of wonder. This is how you must penetrate and study. So, wander into the center of the circle of wonder. So, what can you say about this?
No.
Yes.
How is it that he's not creating a duality between the unconditioned and the conditioned, or between non-duality and duality?
Mm. Mm-hmm. Well, listen to this. In this field, birth and death do not appear. The deep source transcends down, transparent down to the bottom, can radiantly shine and can respond unencumbered to each speck of dust without becoming its partner. So, each speck of dust means getting down to the very bottom and yet responding to conditions.
Similarly, I'm interested in his use of apparent habits.
Apparent habits.
So we have a way in which we relate to our habits that make them somehow seem like they're separate or to be gotten rid of.
Mm-hmm.
But when we grind and polish in whatever away, they are just our habits. They're nothing more than that. They'll still exist. They're still the relative. But we deal with them in a way that's unencumbered.
Deal with them in a way that's unencumbered. I think that's she says we deal with them in a way that's unencumbered. What do you mean by that? I know what you mean by that. But
what I mean is that we don't add anything extra to them. We just see them for what they are. We don't judge, we don't react, we don't try and push them away. We respond appropriately to them because we see them just as they are. Just apparent habits. We don't believe that we are those habits or that we're forever stuck in those habits. We just know that they arise sometimes, and because of our conditioning, they tend to arise more than other things do sometimes.
And if we're in the circle of brightness, do they catch us or no?
I'd say not. I'd say from the circle of brightness, you see them.
And they don't catch you.
They don't catch you. What do you mean by catching, Peggy?
Well, I guess the words he uses are they don't leave a trace. But they don't find your vision.
You know, they don't catch us. We don't catch them. They can't catch us. We can only catch them.
There's a, if you, I think, the next sentence, in the next sentence, or the sentence after, the deep source, transparent down to the bottom, can radiantly shine and can respond unencumbered to each speck of dust without becoming its partner. So
yes,
it's not that specks of dust don't arise, but exactly that you don't become a partner
with
it. Yes. Not that it doesn't become a partner with you.
So this is like, you know, being in the world without being attached. Being able to, because we have touched the bottom, we're able to go through to proceed, responding, but without being caught. But the what's caught is not something catching us, it's we're catching it.
That's the part I know.
Yeah. There's an old Hasidic story. this guy comes to the man comes to the rabbi and says, Rabbi, you know, how can I get rid of the evil urge which is always chasing me around? He says, just stop chasing it. The evil urge is not chasing you. You are chasing it.
Can I try another way of encumbered?
Yeah.
You tried catching, which she tried catch. I would think that I'm wondering if it's what I do when I get kind of obsessed with maybe a habit of mine, usually a negative judgment about it, a fretting about it, and thinking that I have to I have to vanquish it. And a big emotional burden around some aspect of my
burden,
personality.
Yeah, carrying it around, carrying something around.
So if you're unencumbered, you can see it. And I'm wondering if an example of it would be you started out today by talking about the half inch of the mat between the mat and the altar, and then saying, you may think that's picky, and maybe it is.
Mm-hmm.
But I heard no judgment about yourself about being picky,
mm-hmm.
about maybe being picky, maybe it is, but and
yeah.
I'm wondering if that's, is that related? Is that to
I'm,
this?
I'm not burdened by if he thinks that that's being picky.
Okay, but maybe, I was just trying to think of maybe it's your habit. You have this thing that you really
mm-hmm.
want to be a half inch away, and it's important to you. And that's okay with you, that it's important to you.
Yes.
And you might instead think, oh, I shouldn't be so picky.
I don't think that, though.
What that brings up for me is the opposite things. You may have some, you know, habitual, quote, things that you might call a fault.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you just go around saying that's okay for everything, all of your, quote, faults, then maybe that's going off in a direction where you're very self-indulgent or something.
Right.
It may not be positive.
Right, that's right. So, but I'm, you know, if you think that that's picky, I'm not going to deny your truth. I don't think that's right or wrong.
Okay, well, that's about me. It's not about your habit anymore. So maybe it's not a good example and I shouldn't have brought it up.
Yeah.
That would be my habit to think that you're picky.
Yeah. There are habits that are beneficial and habits that are not. You know. But mindless habit is what is talked about, what he's talking about here. Mindless habit, in other words, without really investigating deeply, we respond to something on the surface. We respond to something without really knowing what it is we're responding to or how we're responding. We just respond through a kind of half-truth.
Well, the only way you can be encumbered by those kind of habits is by remaining unaware of them.
That's right.
If you're aware of them, aren't you immediately unencumbered?
No.
No.
Wouldn't that occur?
You could be aware of them and still be, and still continue.
Still not be willing to give them up.
I'm not, okay, maybe I have to think of an example of my own life for that, but I felt it doesn't come up. I wish there was an example for that.
Well, you know, here's an example. We know somebody, and we all know somebody, and then this person has certain characteristics which we respond to, and maybe they have certain characteristics which help to create a conditioned response in me to them, right? So whenever I see so-and-so, I go, oh, that's so-and-so. He's always like this, right? But that's my conditioned response.
Okay.
My true response would be to not have that, to not always think that's the way this person is. Otherwise, I never give that person the opportunity to change in my eyes.
Okay, so if you see your response, to be unencumbered by it is to let it go.
To let, yes, say, oh, that's my response. But
not believe
it. What is that, what's actually, what am I actually facing here?
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. And I think that's the kind of like, you know, getting at an unconditioned response. It's like, instead of just, I know what that is, I don't know. So I don't know is like unconditioned response. Even though I know. Even though I do know, I don't let myself fall into I do know. Even though I know, I don't know. And that's what gives me the opportunity to respond to what's really there instead of what I think is there. It's going to happen. Otherwise, I can't free myself of the other person.
So what is this thing, even though I know that you know?
Yeah, that's that first part. I love that.
Well, but when I say even though I know, I mean, I think I know.
Okay.
That's what that means. And 9 times out of 10, what you think will happen, right? But there's that one opportunity when it won't, and you have to be open to that opportunity. So, to always be open to that opportunity. Because when we respond, we also change the, you know, how, the way we respond has an effect on the other person. Maybe 10 years from now. I don't know. Nancy?
What if the Sangha had quite a few somewhat demented, compulsive people who just insisted on making that zabuton snug up against
the mat.
And, you know, and then every time you would move it back patiently and it just kept happening month after month after month, day after day.
Guess what? you know my life. That's the story of my life. Arrange the altar And day after day, the next day, and the next week, it's the same as it was before. And so then, a year later, I'll do it again. The next day. So it's, you know, this wears down my condition, this life.
That's what I was wondering.
Yeah. It mellows me.
Before you came in here, I noticed that the mat was crooked. And so I leaned forward and straightened it, so I got only 50%.
Yeah. That's good.
Yeah. But that may be all you need.
No, that's half of what you need.
I meant you.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah. I appreciated the fact that it was straight. But I did. Yeah.
Next time, 100%.
See, the thing is, like, you know, when I look at the altar, I want everything to be, because this is the center of our mandala. Even though it's at the end of the, zendo. Typically in a zendo, the altar is in the middle. If you have space, you know, because of our limited space, the altar is at the end, but it should be in the middle. And then the altar is the center of the mandala. So to straighten out, you know, this is where the essence comes from. So we want to make, you know, and when we straighten that up, it straightens us out. We're straightening it out, but it's also straightening us out. It's not like one way. So, but to pay attention, to have that mindfulness and that carefulness and that attention to detail is good for us. And when we do have that attention to detail, then the radiance of the mandala affects the whole zendo. So there's the center of the mandala, and then there are the corners. And each corner has a certain kind of, I don't want to say power, but effect. These two seats and the seat that's over there in the back and the seat over here, although it's not exactly perfect, so to speak. But so this is the center, and our practice radiates, and the zendo radiates out from the center of the mandala. And so the essence or the light radiates out, and our effort, each one of us is a mandala in ourself. So all these energy centers are around the perimeter and in the center are interacting with each other and creating multiple infinite patterns of light. Naomi?
Oh, this brings to mind a famous art educator that I studied a bit named Rhoda Kellogg. And she studied the art of children in cultures all over the world and found that at a certain age, around 3, they began just drawing freely. They always would make a mandala.
Mm-hmm.
And they would want to embellish it gradually, and out of that came the human figure. And sort of corresponding with the child's discovery of self.
Yeah, but mandala is the most natural thing, you know, and it's invented by children. And of course, we're children. And every household is a mandala of one kind or another. Some work better than others. But this is what we're always centering. Zazen is the act of centering. And because we're always accessing or being a vehicle for this life energy, which is called light. So some people are interested in harmony. Some people are interested in chaos. And so it is, you know, the people who love chaos and the people who love harmony. We happen to love harmony, so and the balance of chaos and harmony is always, you know, are always vying with each other, or balancing each other out. So it's always happening. But this is this practice is the practice of being a vehicle for light and harmony.
Yeah. Sort of forgive the thought. Let's say, and let's not use the word picky, but let's say that you're wrong, and it doesn't really belong a half inch, it belongs 3/8 inch, and you keep on insisting on a half inch. Mm-hmm. And when there's a question, it's not mm-hmm. a question of picking, it's a question of when are you wrong? But, you know, God forbid you're wrong. Mm-hmm. But when are you wrong, or are you ever wrong?
Oh, I'm always wrong. Half inch is just a means, you know, a certain distance. It's not a ruler, half inch. It's an eye half inch. It's an eyeballing.
And it might be different from one day to the next.
Aesthetically, it's the best way, though.
Oh, what do I?
Aesthetically, actually, the half inch makes it perfect.
Yeah. Aesthetically, it works. Right. And not only aesthetically does it work, but practically it works. So, you know, if you build a house and you lay the foundation and you're a quarter of an inch off at one end, by the time you get to the other end, you're about 3 feet off, maybe. So you have to be very careful how you lay that out. And that's done with rulers and stuff like that. This is all eyeball. So this is like training your eye to work with objects so that each object has its own space and is not crowded out by some other object or covering up some other object. So sometimes I'll come in and I'll move the flowers because they're covering up Samantabhadra. And so the subtle balances that really make you feel good, and there are imbalances which don't make you feel so good. So balance is part of our practice. Balance is a very fundamental part of our practice. How we balance all of the things that are we're work with, and the balance of the constituents of our body, and the balance of our mind, and the balance of our body and mind. Balance is everything, because everything is continually falling out of balance and finding its balance. So this is our fundamental teaching. How to, moment by moment, regain your balance. So by working this way with the center of the mandala of our practice, very important. Do we ever make mistakes? We make mistakes all the time. But we don't criticize ourselves over mistakes. We simply correct them.
So, just, do you want to take a break?
We do. So anyway, there's a lot in this talk. But this is very typical of Hongzhi, this talk. He's talks about circles. He talks about a lot about light and about illumination. And of course for him, Zazen is the practice of silent illumination. So in a sense, you know, it's not easy to talk about all Zen schools, teaching or teachers will say, yes, Shikantaza is really the highest form of Zen. And all the koans, of course, are resolved in Zazen. But the difficult part is when we stand up. Zazen itself is not so hard, but standing up and walking around, that's difficult. That's where we lose ourselves. So, I'll just read this a little bit more. Now that we kind of talked a little bit around it, he says, the field of boundless emptiness is what exists from the very beginning. You must purify, cure, grind down, or brush away, or however you want to do it, all the tendencies you have fabricated into apparent habits. Then you can reside in a clear circle of brightness. You know, when you come to Sashin, even though this doesn't really always happen, ideally, all of your affairs are in order. You don't have anything hanging over your head when you come to Sashin. Of course, that's impossible. It's not impossible, but it's because of our entanglements in our lives. It's pretty hard. But ideally, you would leave everything behind, as if you were not going to return to Earth again. I remember when I first went to Sokoji with Suzuki Roshi, my first sashin, there was a sign on the wall that said, a matter of life and death. So, the field of boundless emptiness is what exists from the very beginning. You must purify, cure, grind down, or brush away, or whatever. All the tendencies you have fabricated into apparent habits, then you can reside in a clear circle of brightness, which is Zazen. Utter emptiness has no image. Upright independence does not rely on anything. Just expand and illuminate the original truth, unconcerned by external conditions. Accordingly, we are told to realize that not a single thing exists. In this field, birth and death do not appear. The deep source, transparent down to the bottom, can radiantly shine and can respond, unencumbered, to each speck of dust without becoming its partner. The subtlety of seeing and hearing transcends mere colors and sounds. The whole affair functions without leaving traces, and mirrors without obscurations. Very naturally, mind and dharmas emerge and harmonize. Mind and dharmas means Dharma things, mind things. An ancient said that non-mind, or no mind, embodies and fulfills the way of no mind. Embodying and fulfilling the way of no mind, finally you can rest. Proceeding, you are able to guide the assembly. With thoughts clear, sitting silently, wander into the center of the circle of wonder. This is how you must penetrate and study. This is a description of his practice. It's a kind of self-portrait of Hongzhi. I think I gave you another. Well, I gave you several. Can you tell me what the next one might be? That I gave you, or one of those ones that I gave you in your handout.
The practice of true reality.
The practice.
The next one.
It's the next one after Bright Boundless Field was on this page completely. It's on the bottom here, and it's on.
What's the name? What's the number of the page?
Page four.
The whole thing. Not there completely, no.
It is.
Oh, I see. No, it's not. It's
well, yeah, the next page is page five. You see that at all?
Yeah, that's what I said. You know, that just happens to be the end of the page. When we zero, I said, but the whole thing is on page five. Did I give you page five?
Yes.
Okay.
I think you start on the bottom of page four.
I just, but when you said it's all on the bottom of page five, four.
Oh, okay.
That's what I was. Okay. Okay. So, the practice of true reality, according to Hongzhi. The practice of true reality is simply to sit serenely in silent introspection. When you have fathomed this, you cannot be turned around by external causes and conditions. This is called the samadhi of imperturbability. This is one meaning of samadhi, is imperturbability. This is what Suzuki Roshi said, what meant when he said, you should always be the boss. He didn't mean you should boss people around. He meant you should sit in the samadhi of imperturbability. Nothing can turn you over. You can't be turned over. You know that if you sit in the lotus position, this is called a triangle, three-point triangle, to the knees and the behind. And this is the most immovable kind of sitting position, where you can't easily be pushed over. It's a very stable position. Just to extend that a little bit, when the servers are serving a meal to the people on the floor, you should always get down on your knees, put the pot down and get down on your knees to serve. If you're just kind of squatting, it's very unstable. So assuming a stable position always is a practice. Always look for a stable position so that you're never off balance. So if you're kind of squatting on your feet and your knees are up and you're behind that pump, somebody just come along and push you right over. So you should be careful how you move your body and the positions that your body takes to be stable. It's very much like lighting up everything on the altar. There's a feeling of stability, feeling of groundedness and stability. So that's this position, and it's also the position you take when you do various tasks. And so you're always centered in whatever you're doing. This is fundamental Zazen practice in motion. always being centered in all of your movements. When you're driving your car, you're centered here, and this is where your breathing comes to. When you're washing the dishes, you're centered. When you're sweeping the floor, you're centered. When you lift something, you lift it with your legs. Lifting something heavy, you don't lift it like this with your back. You squat and take a stable position, take hold of what you're lifting, and stand up. So you have to think about these things as practice. So he says, when you have fathomed this, you cannot be turned around by external causes and conditions. So physically, yes, but emotionally and mentally, the same thing. Ross.
Thank you. A moment ago when you said the altar is the center of our mandala and all goes out from there, the thought arose in me, well, where is this not the center of the mandala? Where are we in the world where it's not? And so when we're outside the Zendo, we're constantly encountering things that are not centered. And yet, this is our mandala. And so can you give an encouraging word on how to see things that are so-called askew,
mm-hmm. yeah.
centered and in balance, so
yeah.
we don't become obsessive and compulsive and try to...
Yeah, you know, instead of trying to put out all the fires in the world, just center yourself. When you center yourself, then all the uncentered, seemingly uncentered things around you will find their center with you. That's how you center things. You don't try to rearrange them. You simply center yourself, and then whatever it is that's relating to you will be centered with you.
Well, that seems like good advice and encouragement, and feels right. So, coming back to the Zendo, at what point do we just let things, the Zabuton, be a little off, or you know, the various things that we are encouraged to kind of line up? You know, it's really inside, outside.
Yes, so that's very subtle. You do what you can, and then what you can't do, you accept.
Okay.
Without discrimination. So a lot of it's just letting go. If we don't let go, we kill ourselves with trying to make everything right.
Well, I think I was going to say something along those lines. Each of us has our own way of viewing what that alignment is. And when I see something out of line, or I hear something out of line, or I have, before I make an adjustment, I look at myself and see if what I notice is that my response to this is somehow moving me out of alignment, then I tend not to fix that thing that's external. I let it go until a time when I see, okay, then I don't have anything invested in this. This is just making things align. If I'm irritated, so what that means really, if I'm irritated by it or something's bothering me, you know, then that's precisely the time in which I don't make an adjustment externally.
Right. So it can't bother you. You can only bother yourself.
Right, it's me bothering me.
Way in the back, John? No. Oh, yeah, hi.
In response to what Ross was saying also, that makes me think that, you know, we get to come here into this mandala, this Zendo, where everything is kind of...
Can you maybe stand up, because I can't really hear you.
We, we,
into this mandala as a part of it, and things are harmonious and formal, and there's ritual. And I think that when we go outside of the Zendo, our job is, or, you know, this is just an idea, maybe to be our own little walking Zendo, our own mandala going out of there. And this is practice, sort of.
Yes.
It's forming a concept that we then can carry outside.
When you leave the Zendo is extended to wherever you are. That's the practice.
Mm-hmm.
So that's right. What you say is right. And then there's a gentleman in front of you. And they're sitting in the corner. Yeah.
Someone over here.
I was going to ask you, let's go back for a second. In the first one that we read, there is expand and illuminate the original truth. How do you expand? I can get the illuminate, but how do you expand the original truth if it's the original truth?
Well, this is some, I don't know. This is a way of thinking. What I would say was just when you let go, you expand. There's no limit to your boundaries. So we think of this body as a limit. It does have limitations, but actually there's no limitation to our real body. Our true body is the universe. So there's no limit to expansion. But just letting go of what we think is a boundary.
You know, he's reading that as expand the original truth. I would read it differently. I'd say just expand. That's you. Expand. And thereby illuminate the original truth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Two questions. Thinking about the, you know, what's picky, what's an obsessional ritual.
Mm.
I'm wondering if whether we think about it not as getting things exactly aligned right, but more as a process of aligning ourselves.
Yes.
And getting attuned to prepare for moving into liminal space outside of the ordinary hurly-burly of how things are. But going into liminal space involves these rituals of getting things so.
It helps. Yeah.
And the second comment I had was about what is clear and what is pure. It's very reminiscent of the instruction practice in my work, which is being a psychoanalyst, that our practice is to be without mud, M-U-D, without memory, without understanding, without desire.
Well, yes. I would say without attachment to those things. Yeah.
It means exactly that. That who you think the patient is that's walked into the room needs to fall into the background. This is a new person, a new moment,
right.
A new you, no mud.
Well, also, the same thing, you know, reminded me that every time we do something that looks like the same thing, it's different. It's not the same thing. As we keep saying over and over, there's no repetition. We think, oh, this is just repetition. If you think this is repetition, then that's just mechanical. So as soon as it's mechanical, you know that's just a conditioned response or a conditioned way of doing something. So when you actually practice what we call ritual, I don't call it ritual, I just call it procedure. To do it in a very relaxed way so that it's always new. Every time, as Suki Rishi used to say, you know, you have to maintain your original mind, your original intention, which is every time you bow, it's different.
Mm.
It's a whole new thing you're doing. You've never done that before. You did something like that once.
Mm-hmm.
But every time, it's a different experience. It's totally different. There's no repetition, except as we think that maybe it is. We just put it into a category called repetition. Yeah.
I've been thinking this off and on throughout this discussion, and it's kind of fitting in again. When we've been talking about apparent habits and not taking them too seriously, kind of noting them but not clinging to them or defending them or whatever. One of the interesting, pleasant aspects of that, it seems to me, is that, and just dropping, just letting it be, just letting go of it. One of the pleasant aspects of that is to realize there's no value in being consistent, no need to be consistent. In other words, if one has a kind of habitual response to a particular person, you say, oh, here they come and they're going to do their thing and I'm going to get irritated by it and so forth. And there's no need to do that. You may have gotten irritated the last time you saw them, but there's absolutely no need to continue the next time you see them to be irritated. And in fact, if you see them and they happen to, you know, you happen to have a wonderful, pleasant interaction with them, there's no need to feel that that was somehow inconsistent or whatever. It's just what's happening now. It's so kind of nice to not be consistent or even value being consistent.
I think the most important thing is how you stay centered and in the calmness of your mind. I'm going to go on just a little bit. This empty, wide open mind is subtly and correctly illuminating. This empty, wide open mind is subtly and correctly illuminating, spacious and content, without confusion from inner thoughts of grasping, effectively overcome habitual behavior, and realize the self that is not possessed by emotions. Doesn't mean that there are no emotions, but is not possessed by emotions. You must be broad-minded, whole, without relying on others. Such upright, independent spirit can begin to not pursue degrading situations. Not to pursue, it's a funny way. Here you can rest and become clean, pure, and lucid. Lucid means light, right? Bright and penetrating, you can immediately return, accord, and respond to deal with events. Everything is unhindered. Clouds gracefully floating up to the peaks. The moonlight glistening, flowing down mountain streams. The entire place is brightly illuminated and spiritually transformed, totally unobstructed and clearly manifesting responsive interaction like a box and cover or arrow points meeting. So this is from the Sandokai, right? He's quoting from the Sandokai. Like a box and its lid, or like two arrow points meeting perfectly. Continuing, cultivate and nourish yourself to embody maturity and achieve stability. If you accord everywhere with thorough clarity and cut off sharp corners without dependence on doctrines, like the white ox or wild cat helping to arouse wonder, you can be called a complete person. So we hear that this is how one on the way of not no mind acts, but before realizing no mind, we still have great hardship.
What do you mean by sharp corners?
Sharp corners. A realized person has no corners. No place where something can get stuck.
Word again. It's so ambiguous.
Stuck?
Yeah.
Is ambiguous?
For me.
Stuck means stuck in emotions, stuck in feelings, stuck in mental...
Not letting go of it. Not seeing, not letting go.
You know, transparent. Sometimes it should be transparent. But it means like, you know, if you get an arrow, you can either hold it or you can let it go through. So, if we continually allow things to go through, we don't get stuck with them. So we carry all this baggage around us, right with us, because we get stuck with things. We catch them, like you catch a cold. You know, and then, pretty soon, you know, we don't know how to deal with those things that we're stuck with. But, you know, the practice is really, how do you keep letting go moment by moment? There are things that we should be concerned with, you know, and be responsive to, and so forth. But, you know, this is not a rule. It's an attitude. You know, when you start making attitudes into rules, then you start thinking about one, two, three. It's an attitude. You know, sometimes you do get stuck, you know. We do get stuck a lot. But our attitude, disposition, you might say, is to respond to things and let go of things. Let go. So that you're always rising up fresh. This is what he's talking about. You're always, on each moment, you're arising fresh and new because you're dying. Every moment we're dying, and every moment we're rising up new. Letting go and rising up new. And if we don't let go, it's hard to rise up new. So we get stale and we fall behind. And then we start groping our way through life because we're so burdened. So how we not get attached and not get caught and keep letting go all the time. That's called renunciation. That's true renunciation. It's just letting go all the time. Not holding on to anger, ill will, or any of those negative emotions or feelings or thoughts. Which arise all the time. You know, like I get angry 50 times a day when I listen to the radio. Idiots, you know. I hear these people criticize. Obama gives this great speech, and then all these people are criticizing. He didn't cure us, you know. He didn't solve the problems of the world, you know. And, you know, like these guys are just burdening themselves, you know, with all this stuff because they don't want to change. It's hard to change. Really hard to change. Change is one of the hardest things for people to do. And changing for the better is even harder. I have to hand it to Obama. He's really cool. Really cool. Has all these reins on him that don't allow him to do what he wants. And he's just really cool. He's developing time, you know, a little bit at a time. A lot of patience. Pretty patient. He needs a lot of support.
You got a really good necklace from the king.
Of what?
You got a really good necklace from the king.
Oh, he did?
Yeah.
I didn't see that.
A gold necklace from King Abdullah, mm-hmm. Saudi king.
Okay, we have no time. So I will give you something to study from Ko'un Angel over the week. But that's just a that's just a taste of Hongzhi, and I would hope that my understanding of a class is to help to just kind of encourage everybody to just study something in the long run. So please, keep doing this.